This is the Nobel Podcast, where we talk about how to optimize your technology, life, and mind. We're joined by special operations veterans, entrepreneurs, investors, and others who have overcome difficulty to make it to the top of their craft by staying in the fight. What's your name?
Mike Layef.
Where'd you grow up?
Glenside, Pennsylvania.
Tell me about selling candy.
Even though my house was like right on the cusp of like you could walk or you could take the bus. And every now and then I took the bus to junior high, but I usually just walked. I liked walking in the morning. I walked with some of my friends. Sometimes I just walked by myself. And you know, we always walked past this place. It was called Lee Mart at the time. It was this little mini mart. And that's like where kids would go and buy cigarettes and shit. They didn't care. Like they would sell, you could have been 5 years old. They would have sold you a pack of cigarettes. But I was walking past them one morning and they're, you know, stocking shelves. They had a supply truck outside dropping off a bunch of goods. And I saw boxes of Airheads. And I was like, I loved Airheads. And they were like the new thing at the time. And I was like, how much is the box of Airheads? I don't remember the pricing on it or whatever. But there would be like a box of like 500 or something. And I could get the box for roughly a nickel per Airhead. And the guy saw me all the time because I would always stop in and get a soda or something on the way home from school. And I got him to front me a box of Airheads. And I said I would pay him by the end of the week. And then so I took the Airheads to school, opened up the box, dumped it in my bag, took some books out. You know, my product was more important. And I started slinging them in school for a quarter apiece. I was making like $100 to $200 a week in change from selling Airheads. So on Friday, I'd go to the bank with a school bag full of change and dump it at that bank, which was down the street from my house, Abington Bank. Got the change, swapped it out for cash, went and paid him, and then I netted the profit. And I did this for basically the whole school year. I was like the candy guy at school. And my principal is, I wonder if he's still around. His name was Mr. Worthington. He was a badass. He was like, I think he was a veteran. And one day he snatched me up in the hallway and he was like, get to my office. And they called my parents. My dad had to leave work because I was in the office to come pick me up because I was getting suspended. And my dad was like, why is he in trouble? He thought like I did something like really bad. He was like, selling Airheads in school. My dad looked at me and I'm like, he thought like he had no idea what the hell Airheads were even were. And I was like, I'm selling candy. And he like looked back. He's like, you called me out of work to come in here to pick up my kid for selling candy? He's like trying to run a business. Shouldn't you be teaching them about business in school? It was like, my dad was so fucking pissed. And that ended my candy days just for a little bit. And then I started trying to do it again, but I got caught again. But they didn't suspend me this time. They were like, we're going to kick you out of fucking school if you keep it up. And I was like, all right. So I stopped.
Squash the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I vaguely recall you told me a story once about fences and your dad. Does that ring a bell?
Basically, when I got in trouble, it wasn't so much like, hey, you're grounded, go to your room. It was like physical labor. We had two garages when I was growing up. They were both two-car garages. They were big. I was going around the garage, chipping all the flaky paint and then putting two coats over it. And the one day I did it all by myself. And my friends were like, you can come out. I was like, no. Next day I was out there chipping. Or can you come out? I'm like, no, not until I get this done. Next day my friends come by. And I was like, yo, you know what, guys? I didn't need it like another guy for to play football or whatever. I don't even remember what we were doing. And I convinced them all to help me paint the garages so I could get out. So I had like eight kids in my backyard painting with me. So I knocked the two garages out in 3 days. And my dad came home from work. I came home from playing with my friends and he was sitting there. I was like, oh my God, he looks like he's going to kill me. And I was like, what? And he was like, why'd you go out? I'm like, the garages are done. And he was like, how the hell did you get these garages done so fast? And I was like, well, I got everyone to help me out. And so he ended up making me paint the fence after that. And now he said I had to do it by myself. So my punishment continued. He didn't let me squeal my way out of that one.
He's got some wisdom.
Yeah.
So what was the earliest memory you had of wanting to become a sealer?
It was like fourth, fifth grade.
That's early.
Yeah. So I got punished. And I wasn't allowed to watch TV. And, you know, I was pacing around the house, driving my parents nuts. Both my parents are like, read a ton, and they always have. And so my mom was like, read a book. I was like, I don't want to read a book. And then she was like, come on. And we went to Barnes & Noble bookstore. I used to love going to Barnes & Noble and just like hanging out for hours, like especially when we're in the military, like we're on a training trip. I used to be like, just go by myself, get a Starbucks, and like walk around and look at a ton of shit. But anyway, I found myself in a military section, and there was a book there, and a guy was all painted in camouflage, and it looked like he was hiding in the jungle, and it had a big golden SEAL trident on it. I didn't even know what a Navy SEAL was, let alone a SEAL trident. And it just looked fucking badass. And I was like, it was like glowing there for me to take it. So I took that book, read it, and it was about the first SEAL platoons in Vietnam. So it was just like frogman stories. I mean, if I read it now, I might think differently of it. But at the time, I was like, dude, this is fucking bad. Who are these guys? And we didn't have the internet or nothing then. So I was like looking for more. And there wasn't that many SEAL books at the time. I think Rogue Warrior was my next book. Dang, and of course, like that, yeah, everyone got fucking hooked on that. But then the movie Navy SEALs came out with Charlie Sheen right around the same time. And me and my brother must have watched that 1,000 times easily. And I was like, I want to be a Navy SEAL. I'm going to fast forward, make it through SEAL training. And I graduate. My parents are at the graduation. My family's there. And my dad handed me my sixth grade yearbook. And I was like,
the hell's this?
The fuck you giving me this for? I totally forgot I wrote this, dude. And in the sixth grade yearbook, I wrote, I'll be a Navy SEAL working on top secret missions, yada, yada. So I wrote that when I was in like the beginning of sixth grade, where every other kid was like, I'm going to be a Philadelphia 76ers. I'm going to be professional baseball player, whatever. I'm like, I'm going to be in the military, being a Navy SEAL. I said, I will be a Navy SEAL working on top secret missions. I'll have little to free time for my family.
So you got in trouble, got into a lot of fights, decided you were going to enlist and become a SEAL.
Yeah.
Talk about the story of how you got over the past instances of causing trouble and then finally making your way into the SEAL teams. What you had to go through to get that?
So me enlisting in the Navy wasn't an easy road. So 9/11 happened. First of all, I was in college and I was a straight knucklehead. My grades were average to piss poor. I was focused way more on partying and et cetera. I went through four different undergrads. My first college, I had a 0.0 GPA after my first semester. I was supposed to be there to play football. Then I left and I came home. My dad was like, I'm not paying for you to go to college. Like, so I was working a construction job full time, digging ditches. At night, part time, I would work at a pizza shop, and on the weekends I would bounce at a bar. But I was also taking two college classes to like get my credits going. At Penn State Abington, which is like a satellite campus of Penn State Maine. I was thinking I'll get some good grades over the next two semesters, going part-time, and I could get into Penn State Maine. So I did that for the spring semester, went through the summer doing the same thing, and took some summer classes. In the fall, I stopped working construction and did a full fall semester and just worked part-time at tossing pizzas and bouncing at this bar on the weekends. And one day I dropped out and I was like, fuck this. I went down to a travel agency shop, walked in. I was like, I need a plane ticket to get me to Lake Tahoe. They're like, how much money do you have? I had like $300 or something. And they're like, we can get you to Reno. I'm thinking snow and ski places. I had no idea where Reno. And the reason I picked Lake Tahoe, because there's a guy that also bounced at this bar that I bounced at that went out there like a year and a half earlier, and he was bartending out there, and all these stories were coming back. I was like, this place sounds like heaven. I was like, I gotta go there. So I really had no plan. Got a plane ticket for like that weekend. I made sure I had enough cash to like last me like a week. I had a couple ski resorts like written on a piece of paper to get to. I told my parents I was dropped out of school again and I'm moving to Lake Tahoe, and I thought my dad was gonna kill me, dude. Took the train down to the airport, flew to Reno, got out in the middle of the fucking desert. And I was like, oh my God, where's the snow in the mountains? I flagged down a taxi, and the taxi was like, you know, where are you going? I'm like, Lake Tahoe. I looked like a poor little kid. He was like, how much money do you have? And I showed him a lot. He was like, it was like $100 cab ride or something back then. And he's like, where are you going in Lake Tahoe? I was like, take me to Sugar Bowl Ski Resort. And then he took me to Sugar Bowl Ski Resort. And I got there and walked into the administration office, and they hired me on the spot. They're like, yep, they needed bodies. And what they had like a dorm building on the grounds where all the employees lived. It was fucking awesome. I lived there for a couple months and just, I was a ski ball. And I went to Cancun for a while with my friends, and I moved to this beach house. And then finally I was like, all right, I got to get my shit together. And I applied to a couple different colleges. And my dad was like, I'll make a deal with you. You get accepted to one of these colleges, the first one you get accepted to, I'll help you get there. He was like, but then you're completely on your own. He was like, I'm gonna get you set up. And he was like, but then it's all on you. This is your last shot. And so I was like, all right. So I knuckled down there for the next 2 years and I did really well. Like I got my grades up. I mean, I wasn't like a 4.0, but I was like a 2.5 GPA, but I was having a great time. Everything was good. And then 9/11 happened. And I was like, I don't know, that seed that was planted when I read The Men Behind the Trident just exploded. And I was like, oh, I know what I got to do. I waited. It took like another semester and a half, but I remember sitting in a class. I must have nodded off or something, and a professor started giving me a bunch of shit. Like looking back on it, I was an asshole. But like at the time, I was like, fuck this guy. Fuck this class. I'm out of here. I walked to the Navy recruiter. I was like, I want to go to the Navy. They're like, awesome. Because they're car salesmen and they want to take everyone that walks through the door. And they're like, I started filling out all this paperwork. They're like, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to be a SEAL. And they basically were like, yeah, right, whatever, like laugh. And I was like, okay, that's the only thing I want to do. Give me a SEAL. And at the time, they had a SEAL Challenge contract. And you would pick a rate. I think when you went in, they already had the pipeline through Bud's Prep.
I got to go straight to Bud.
So at this time, it was a thing called a SEAL Challenge contract where you would pick a certain job. Like, not every job would qualify you to go to Bud's. Where I went down to MEPS, did like the whole medical stuff, did the ASVAB, and I crushed the ASVAB. They were trying to get me to like think about crypto or Nuke. And I was like, no, I don't want to do either of those things. And then I picked PR, parachute rigger, because I was like, what's going to get me to boot camp the fastest?
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, parachute rigger. And I was like, that's it. But then it got held up when I started doing the background check stuff because I've been arrested so many times. And all my arrests were like disorderly conducts, underage drinking, fights, that kind of shit. I wasn't like jacking cars or like robbing houses. I had to get waivers. And at the time, they were trying to recruit hard because like 9/11 just happened. Like everything was getting increased. And I was thirsty. He was like, dude, we can't let you in. And I was like, come on, what do I need to do? And I'm summarizing multiple conversations, but what the gist of it was is like, if you get a letter from each judge that you have ever seen saying that they like bless this for you to go in, the guy was just fucking with me because he didn't think I would actually go and do it. I was like, okay, that's what I'll do. And I've been to like probably roughly like six, seven different judges, like different counties in Pennsylvania, New Jersey. I would like sit outside the courthouses. They're like, what are you doing here? I'm like, just sign this thing. Have the judge sign this. And like, they're just like, laugh, like you're fucking crazy. No. And I was like, all right, I'll just sit here and wait. I just keep knocking on the window, keep knocking on the door. And I didn't get all of them, but I did get a handful. I was like, I think I have enough. Went back to Pittsburgh, handed it to my recruiter, said, take this to the captain. So then the captain has a meeting with me and he's just like shocked that I did it. And he's like, all right, we're gonna get your waiver. He was like, but you don't qualify for the SEAL Challenge contract. You have to go to boot camp, go on a regular Navy, and then eventually you could try out for Buds if you want to. So then I went to boot camp. At boot camp, they asked for volunteers to try the test to go to SEAL training. I did that, passed, went and did an interview with the guys, and they said the same thing. They're like, hey, we can't. You have too much in your record here with waivers. They're like, you have to go to the fleet for 2 years and prove you're not a shitbag, and then apply again. And that's what I did.
You always pick the hard way.
Dude, no, nothing's been easy. Nothing's been easy. I went through boot camp, went through my A school in Pensacola, Florida. I got orders to shore duty. It was a RAG squadron, like a training squadron. I got married during this time too. And I was like super young. Like I was only 21, 22 years old getting married. All I did was work and train, work and train. Like I was waking up in the mornings and swimming. I was running in the afternoons. I was lifting weights in between and doing my push-ups and pull. Oh, you know how it goes. And I was just, and I had no idea really how to train. I was just like figuring I'd put myself through as much pain as possible, and that would help me get through training. Got my orders. I was ecstatic. And at the time I got my orders, my wife was pregnant with my first daughter. She was born right before we left for California. We packed up the car, drove cross country to California, checked in, and we were supposed to class up. At the time, they like canceled the winter class. The whole class was in PTR for 6 months. It was like 6 months of first phase. It was fucking
not even
ridiculous.
Sustainable.
Yeah, it was fucking ridiculous. But it was fun. Like I had a blast doing it. And then we finally classed up and started going through first phase. And then when I was in first phase, my wife, we were walking to the Navy Exchange and she was like doubling over in the parking lot. She was like, there's something wrong. I was like, suck it up. You know, everything's fine. She was like, no, there's something really wrong. I was like, all right, let's just go to the hospital. It was a Sunday when we went to the hospital, and she ended up, her appendix burst. She was in a bad way. She was in the hospital for 2, 3 weeks because like she got so septic inside. But she was breastfeeding our daughter at the time. So now, like immediately, my daughter's not breastfeeding anymore. I have to figure out formula and feed her at night. Her mom's in the hospital, but like my parents came out and her parents came out to help. But still, there was like this in between. I was like,
This is while you're in first phase.
yep. Looking back, what I should have done was talk to the command and been like, hey, my wife's in the hospital. This is what happened. We have a newborn at home. And they would have just rolled me to the next class. But I was already there for like 8 months because of PTRR that I was like, me being a fucking blockhead. So that was tough. And then like my daughter wasn't taken to the formula. We ended up figuring out she had to switch to soy formula. It was a fucking mess. And it just added an extra level of stress that you don't need when you're at Buds. Anyway, if we get in the hell week before hell week started, I had cellulitis like all my crotch. It was in my armpits. It was in my butt crack. We had like a breakout in our class, and there was a couple other guys, and we used to have to go to the medical, and they would pop the cellulitis and squeeze. Did you get cellulitis when you were there?
No.
It's awful. Hurts so bad. And it stinks too. So they put me on a bunch of antibiotics when we started hell week, and like they fucked up my stomach because I didn't want to eat, and it was a mess. Whatever. I fucking ended up quitting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so I remember there was a trigger point where I was hurting, and one of the instructors, and he was just like yelling at our boat crew, like, well, whatever, they're doing the instructor thing. And I remember looking at him, and I was like, fuck this guy. You know what I mean? Like, who's this guy? He was a tiny instructor, whatever. It was me being an asshole again. And I just let my mind went over on that one. And I just got up. I was like, I'm done. I hit the bell and I left. And I went to sleep right away. You have to go sleep in a barracks because of med checks and stuff. And I woke up the next morning and I was like, oh, what the fuck?
So it took that whole night of sleep, and then the next morning it hit you what you just did.
Yep.
Man.
I was devastated, dude. Someone ran over my puppy. I was like, fuck. And so I didn't want to go back to the fleet. I was like, all right, I'm going to go EOD. Or I'm going to try to. So I went over to the EOD office. I had to go take the PST because there was a couple at the time. There was a couple guys that dropped from training, but they were able to get orders to EOD, and I was hoping to go on that train. And it was working out. Like I was getting processed through admin. It looked like it was going to work out. And I was walking across the grinder one day with my records from the record office, and I remember Instructor Dallas Reyes was there. So if you ever listen to this, thank you. He was our proctor at first phase, or through PTRR, and I think our proctor switched at first phase. But he was our proctor for like 6, 8 months. It was crazy. He was like, what the fuck, man? I was like, I know, I fucked up. He was like, yep, well, what are you going to do now? I was like, I'm applying to go to EOD. He was like, why are you doing that? I was like, well, I don't want to go to the fleet. Like, he's like, why'd you join the Navy? And I was like, to be a SEAL. He's like, well, then go be a fucking SEAL. Go talk to your detailer. Go get orders as soon as possible. Doesn't matter if it's a shit job or not. Just fucking take it and crush it, and you could get back. And I was like, you know what? You're right. Stopped my AOD package, called my detailer. I got sent to Japan, moved out to Japan with my family. I was there like 15 months, but I was on a ship, dude. I was haze gray and underway all the time because we were forward deployed. Even though I was working with an air squadron, we were like constantly deployed on the USS Kitty Hawk. So I finished college, like I finished my credits at night and everything. And eventually got back to Buds.
So the first time went through, quit. So part of like Zero Eyes is so huge because it's like an endless process of iteration, A/B testing, left and right boundaries, trial and error. So what was the talk track like inside of your head, Buds number two versus number one, knowing what you know now, knowing what it's like in the fleet, knowing what it's like to ring the bell. But then also on top of it, your second time, you were the senior enlisted leader of your team, of your
Yeah,
class.
as LPO. Yeah.
What was your headspace like there?
I worked a lot on my mental stuff, and I was like, because that negativity is always going to creep into your head at some point. Anything you do in life, you got that fucking voice in your head that's like telling you you're no good, or you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not fast enough. Constant fight in my head, like, you shut the fuck up. I'm running this train. And it's funny when you make that switch. I think all team guys are really good at this. And it's like, some people already have it, but like some people make the switch when they're in SEAL training. And then like that drives you through the rest of your life. Being a class leader helped because I didn't want to let anyone down, and it kept me focused on everyone else except for myself. So even when like the pain train was happening or something, I was just like, whatever. Like, let's just keep crushing. And I used to always tell people this. I'm like, hey, just don't focus on finishing SEAL training. Don't even focus on finishing a phase. Don't even focus on finishing the fucking month. Don't even focus on finishing the week. Don't even focus on finishing the day. Just get to the next fucking meal. You start struggling getting to the next meal, just focus on your next step. Put one foot in front of you. Like, if you start thinking like, oh my God, I got another year of this, like, we'll destroy you.
I can't remember how many times you said that, just running zeros alone.
Yeah, like, just one foot in front of the other. Like, trying to eat an elephant, dude, one bite at a time. That's it.
Talk about the concept of what is a Buds Honor Man and what does it take to become one? Because you were the Honor Man of your Buds class, correct?
Buds class, yeah, not SQT though. I was honored to get it, no pun intended. I was not the fastest guy. I was not the best swimmer. I was not the strongest. I did stay the LPO through the whole time in Buds. Class votes on it and the instructors vote on it. And I got it. And I was like, oh shit, that's fucking badass. Thanks.
It's a cool tradition. So I asked Rob the same question because it's a fascinating question. You go from graduating Buds, graduating SQT at the absolute top of your game, top of your physical performance, your mind's in the right spot, ready to crush whatever. Mm-hmm. And then day one, you check into the teams and you're a fucking new guy.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that?
And you get your soul crushed.
Exactly. Talk about that. What was that like? And what was the use of it? What was the utility?
I was expecting it, but I didn't realize how bad it could get. Like, hey, when you check into a team as a new guy coming out of SQT, it's like, stand the fuck by. Yeah. Hopefully they're still doing that in the teams, because when you finish SEAL training, you feel like you could crush anything. Like, you're on top of the world. Like, you feel like you're bulletproof. You need that ego slap. And that's a good thing. So that they make sure you check it at the door. And it's a good lesson in humility, just because, like, life is fucking hard. You want to be something, you want to do something that's incredible, it's going to be fucking hard. And we learned it at the best place, I think.
So while you're in, you want to talk about the difference between the different mission sets, because you saw a pretty full spectrum. You saw VSO, mm-hmm. you saw direct action, you augmented foreign special forces. Can you talk about a little bit about each of those?
We knew we were going to Afghanistan, closer to the border of Pakistan, basically in the middle of fucking nowhere. It was just a platoon living at the edge of Afghanistan. Basically, our mission orders was like, don't let the Taliban take control over here again. But what's crazy, so we relieved SEAL Team 3. And when we got there, those guys were like, you could tell they had a hell of a fucking deployment, especially as a new guy. Like, you're all fired up, full of piss and vinegar, and you want to go fucking take everything on. And you got there and you looked at these guys and you're like, whoa, they need a break. Like, these guys need to get the fuck out of here. But before them, at that same location, there was like 150 Army soldiers or something at the same place. And they almost got overrun. So you take 150 people out and swap them with like 12 dudes.
That's the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah. It was like an interesting time because Obama was in office. The rules of engagement were trying to change. It was like basically you had to get fucking shot before you shot someone. It was ludicrous. I got there at night, got sleep. I woke up in the morning to rockets and mortars coming in. I was like, what the fuck? Like, this shit's real. That first 3-4 months of deployment, it was just that. They're just constantly attacking our base, jumping on a wall, rocking the 50 cal or whatever gun you're getting on. And then we were trying to go out and hit them because they would change like their point of origin sites all the time. So we were trying to set ambushes and traps. And dude, we got really fucking creative. When I read those books as a kid of what those guys were doing in Vietnam, it was like, that's what we were doing those first three. I was like, this is what I was looking for. And then winter started setting in. You know how winter is over there. Fucking everything dies off. Well, a couple of weeks into it, I mean, you guys, our sister platoon, had the Hilo crash, which was devastating. And then Gibby, I know, got wounded. And a couple other guys, like, he got hit by an IED. So, like, and then we had guys start getting fragged. And it was like, I was like, okay, this shit's, like, really picking up. We got to take the fucking gloves off and stop, like, playing patty cake here. And we did a phenomenal job of it. We went hard into the paint for a couple weeks, and then there was no one left to attack us. So right. It was like, all right, what do we do now? So then we got pushed into the VSO mission. VSO stands for Village Stability Operations. It's a very focused Green Beret style mission. The Green Berets are like awesome at it. The idea of it was to go live in a village with the locals, not the whole platoon, just a handful of people, and sit and drink tea with them and went over their hearts and minds and help them build security to keep Taliban in. Sounds great on paper. In reality, on the ground, totally different animal. Basically, our chief was like, all right, life, go hang out with these Green Berets for 2 weeks. And so I went and stayed at a VSO for 2 weeks with these Green Berets, and it was actually very active. Fucking got a bunch of RPGs shot at us the first day I was there. Took a bunch of small arms fire. Got ambushed the one time. It was interesting tactics that we were using. I wasn't the happiest camper. I almost got killed like 3 times in like 10 days. I was like, Jesus fucking Christ, I want to get back to my team. It was just different from the way we operated. And so we got back to the team. We found a place to go do VSO. There's no electricity over there, no plumbing. It's like you step back in a time machine to biblical times. It's fucking wild. Living in a mud hut. It was just a fucking suck fest. That was a wrap on that first deployment. So my second deployment, we started off at UCOM, and then I got sent over to do JPAT. So I went over, did the Poland mission with them. So you worked with the Polish Grom, but we also had guys working with the Polish JWK. We're working in Paktika and Ghazni province. Grom was very aggressive. Well, too aggressive. A bunch of guys got ambushed on this one op. Their commander got killed. Their commander was like in a stack on the door. It was a fucking mess. And so they got shut down. All my work was focused on JWK. They had the potential to be aggressive, but their hands were severely tied from their own country and the whole NATO thing. So they kind of leaned on me to be the aggressor because our ROEs were slightly different. And we were just targeting homemade explosive and IED factories. We planned for an op for like 10 to 14 days. So that op tempo was slow, but you would just do a fast, like you get on birds, fly out, hit a target, hang out for a bit, and then turn around and come back. It was like in and out. Our tempo was like one every roughly 2 weeks. So I wish the tempo was higher, but it was a great experience because I had to sit there and work with them and coordinate. Did they have the right intel to put a target package together? Are they getting the assets? Like I would have to go help and try to get them birds. And so I was going over to the Army side of the house, the battle space commander, and talking to like the colonels and the one stars. And I'd be like, hey, help me get birds. We can hit these HMA places while you guys... Because they were trying to figure out how they're getting like certain equipment and people out of certain areas. A fucking awesome experience.
So let's bridge the gap between 2013 and 2018 when we founded Zero Eyes. There's a thread that kind of winds its way through that transition where guys are looking for something that they lost and then eventually somehow find it. And I think thanks to you, a lot of us found that in 2018 with Zero Eyes. You want to talk about that transition?
Every time you deploy or when you go into combat, those days were gone. And I always tell people, I'm like, it's like practicing for a sport like football. It's like practicing for football all the time and never getting to play in a game or never getting to go to the championship. It would be exhausting. Like you're constantly just on a practice squad or something. I didn't want to do that. And plus, at this point, my marriage was shit. I had 3 kids, never saw them. I was like, all right, time to do something different. And so I applied to B school. I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I thought B school would help me figure it out. So I was like, I'll apply to B school to get my master's in business. And I was like, well, if I'm going to go to get my master's, I'm going to go to a top-notch school. So I just focus on the top schools. And then I got into Wharton, and I was like, fuck yeah, it's in Philly. It's where I grew up. So it was an easy choice. Moved back, went to school, talk about culture shock. I did not fit, but Wharton has an awesome veterans club. So there were some other team guys. It was great. So like once I found and seeked out the other veterans and then you start making friends with people that aren't veterans and it loosens up. But I was in a tough spot at the time. And going back to school, especially a hard business school, like talk about getting fucked in the face. It was like,
it's almost worse than making a new guy in some ways.
Yeah. I thought I was going to fail out. But I finished business school and then we had no idea what to do. Me and you jumped into doing a search fund together, which also learned a ton in that, but it was like, it's like walking around in the dark, trying to find something but you didn't even know what you were looking for.
Yeah.
But then ultimately we started Zero Eyes and you know, and it's roughly 80% of our employees are veterans from all branches and it's fucking badass. It's awesome.
You talk about the risk. You talk about that journey from during the transition to get back to like, what matters, what's your meaning. I still don't get how you were able to drop literally everything to found Zero Eyes. You could have been a made man at Comcast. Mm-hmm. You were doing well with real estate on the side. Yeah. You had all sorts of hustles. You were going to make it big. How did you literally drop everything to start Zero Eyes? And why is more importantly?
It did. Just tired of seeing the fucking school shootings in the United States. I mean, nothing's changed since Columbine, right? And you have all these people, all these talking heads, and you get all these politicians like, never again, sending our prayers and all this other. Like, who's taking action? Who's actually doing something to help here? And I get it. It's like Zero Eyes isn't like the end all be all for active shooters. Do I think it could significantly help first responders and decrease in response time. So yeah, absolutely. But I was like tired of turning on the news and seeing another school shooting and then another school shooting, or even active shooters that weren't even like at the Virginia Beach Municipality Center. And that was right down the street from my house when I lived in Virginia Beach. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, it's only gotten worse since Columbine. And Columbine happened when I was a senior in high school. It was just like a weird epiphany. I was just sitting there. I was like, I think we can make this work. I'm going to do everything in my power to try. Are we perfect? No, but it's been a hell of a ride. Here we are 6 years later. Literally, it was 6 years ago this month when it was like I quit my job, sold all the real estate, and just went all in. And look, we've already detected with people with guns and gotten arrests. I mean, they weren't the active shooter and the nefarious actor were like that we really want, but we don't know how many lives we saved with just getting those handful of people already. That's just the beginning.
But that doesn't come about, right? Unless you take that massive risk. So, like you called me and the other guys. We literally quit our jobs to do this with you. Let's approach the leadership then from that direction. How do you tie in your leadership your second time through at Butts, your leadership starting Zero Eyes, that willingness to take a risk despite severe consequences? How do you think about that other people might be able to learn from it?
At least in a business context, I was just like, dude, what's the worst going to happen? It doesn't work, but we get an egg in our face, or our egos are bruised because we have a failed business. So what? But there's so many lessons learned in there. There's always a silver lining. Sometimes you have to search really hard for it. And I remember when we closed down the search fund, I was a failure, but it was like, but it wasn't because we, the way we learned to do due diligence and stuff while we were in the search fund and think about seller notes and stuff, I turned around and applied that to real estate right away. And it was like, boom, I started closing all those real estate deals. I would have never been able to do that if I didn't do the search fund. So was the search fund really a failure? No, it was a win. And I looked at the business and I was like, all right, what's the worst that could happen? It doesn't work out. It fails. We have to go back out and get jobs. We'll get a job. Like, I'll go be a fucking landscape. I'll go back to construction of what I was doing in high school and balance at a bar if I have to make money and put food on the table. It's not the end of the world. Like, figure it the fuck out. If there's a will, there's a way, man.
It's one thing I'm always amazed at with you, especially in Zero Eyes, is your patience to see how a situation unfolds. You just sit back and you say, let's see what happens. Where does that come from?
When I was in the teams, I would react differently to things. Like, I wouldn't have as much patience to see how something like the situation would develop. But you turned me on to a book a long time ago.
Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel
Yes.
Kahneman, yeah.
Thank you. And I was like, oh my God, that's like, I'll think fast and want to react fast.
Yeah.
You can still think fast, but react slow. And like that whole concept there. And I was like, so now, as much as I want to, like, I hear something and I like want to jump out of my skin and make something happen right away, I'm like, okay, give it 24 hours. Do I have to make a decision on this right now? A lot of times the fucking problems just go away. You know what I mean? Like, they just like dissipate. If it doesn't go away, then it's like, all right, let's find a root cause here. And then you think you find a root cause, dig a little bit more, do the double root cause. You think you have the root cause of something, but go deeper. There's another root in there. And it takes time to find that. And 50% of solving a problem is just stating the fucking problem. Sometimes people don't even know what the problem is. And it's like, all right, everyone knows there's fires going on. What's the problem? And sometimes you ask that in a room and it's crickets. People are like, oh. So you try to like, all right, we think this is the problem. Okay, well, what's causing that? And you work your way backwards. And you need time to do that. And sometimes those answers just unfold themselves in a way.
I know you have three rules for your kids. I wonder how much those rules actually impacted you and your leadership. What are those three rules?
Yeah, so first one's the golden rule. Treat others the way you want to be treated. Pretty fucking simple. The second one is, if you want to get better at something, you practice. And the third one is pretty easy. You get knocked down, get back up, stay in a fight. Because if you're trying to, like, Zero Eyes, for example, how many times have we been knocked down? It happens daily at this point. You just get back up. I got punched in the gut again. Get back up, keep moving forward. Like, we know we're trying to do something good. So that's, in the end, it's going to work out no matter what.
What are some things you do every day? Some rituals you have? I know you like your heat, you like your cold, you like some other things that keep you sane during like the severe ups and downs of Zero Eyes. What do you do on a daily basis?
I try to stay consistent with a lot of it, and it's changed a lot over the last couple of years. Sleep is like my number one now. And it wasn't always, but like, dude, I need 7 to 9 hours of sleep.
Right.
If I get less than that, I'm not operating at 100%. Like, I want to operate at 100%.
I know when you're not sleeping because I get a slack at 4 in the morning.
Because and the stress, it will wake me up. It will wake me up at like 3 in the morning. And when I know it wakes me up like that, I'm like, I'm not going to be able to go back to sleep and just sit there and toss and turn. So I'm like, fucking just lean into it. And then you get it off your plate, and then I'll go take a nap. And it, sometimes if it's really bothering me, but I'm not leaning into it, like I'll just go and I don't journal, but I'll go grab like just a piece of paper out of a printer or a random fucking notebook, and I'll just write. At the time that I'm writing all this stuff out, I'm like, this is the plan. This is going to be a masterpiece. And then I dump it all out of my head, and I go back to sleep. And I go and look at it in the morning, and I'm like, this is fucking gibberish. But it made me feel better. But that's not part of my ritual. I'll do that sometimes. Like, I haven't done it probably in a couple months. So my rituals, getting up in the morning, I have a cup of coffee. I try not to eat until lunch. I was always a huge breakfast guy, but I really try to stick to the intermittent fasting. I try to eat from like 12 to 8. Try to keep that window. I look at my schedule before I go to bed at night, so like I'm not super surprised in the morning or forget something. But I try to get all my emails out before my kids even get up. I try to do that like first thing in the morning, so the ball's out of my court, and then I could go back and look at my emails at the end of the day, and so I'm not stuck in a fucking email inbox all day. The sauna and a cold plunge, dude. That's like,
Life changing.
it's fucking crack. It's awesome. It's life changing. So I try to do that every day. Get a workout in 3 times a week. Is it lifting weights or is it running or I hit the fucking Rogue Fitness bike? Something. Maybe once a week I'll do a workout where it gets me to like my puking thing. I don't do that as much as I used to because it takes me longer to recover. And then at night, I try to really shut it all off around like 8 or 9. And I'll do like a cleanup sweep on messages. Like, I'll look through our Slack messages real quick, which I probably should stop doing because sometimes it makes me stay up later. That's really it. I try to keep it pretty balanced. I do block my calendar from 8 to 10, and then nothing after 3:30 p.m. You need time to stop and like reset your fucking brain.
We're running out of time, so to finish it up, do some rapid fire Q&A, fast as you can answer. If you could have a conversation with one human being, dead or alive, who would it be?
Alexander the Great.
That's a good one. If you could have a billboard with anything on it, what would it be?
It would just be about the golden rule.
Nice. What are 3 books you think would change people's lives?
I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad when I was like, when I first, when I was like 16, 17. That really changed the way I thought about just work and time. Like, where's your time going for dollars that you receive?
MBA or Rich Dad, Poor Dad?
Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Yeah, you don't need an MBA to be an entrepreneur or something. Like I did that for, we did that for transition, like because we had, we're coming off a war, but you don't need an MBA to like go start a company. No, absolutely not. Rich Dad, Poor Dad. It just puts you in a different frame set, different mindset. Musashi was great, dude.
Musashi's epic.
That was my most recent one, so it's been top of mind. I'm gonna have to say, go for Musashi. And I'm trying to, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow was great. I don't know why I'm blanking on it, but it was my like all-time favorite book. I've told you this before too.
Got a Monte Cristo.
Yes, thank
Oh,
you.
that's a great
I
book.
don't know why I was blanking on that.
Also a great movie.
That's probably like my number one book.
What about 3 movies you think would change people's lives?
I mean, you got Braveheart, it's fucking epic.
Epic.
Gladiator, epic. And Last of the Mohicans.
Classic movie.
That's it for this episode. If you want to check out more from the podcast, head to zeroeyes.com/Nobel, where you can see show notes, read more about our guests, and suggest guests or topics of your own. Until next time, stay in the fight, don't ring the bell.